This month, Mike from Port Jeff Brewing Company.
We are a 7-barrel brew house that opened in September of 2011. Has anybody had our beer before? Show of hands. Cool. We just kind of got into the New York City market in December. Some places in Brooklyn, a lot of places in Queens, and some of the places in the city. We're a production brewery, but we have a pretty large tasting room element. Port Jefferson is essentially a tourist type of town, and we're located right in the middle of that, which is nice. We have a tiny tasting room, probably a little bit larger than this booth right here, and we serve anywhere from 5 to 8 beers on draft in the tasting room at any given time. Last year we did about 750 barrels, but we did expand in the middle of the year. We added 2 more fermenters, so we went from about 40 barrels of fermentation space to 70 barrels of fermentation space. I know those numbers are daunting at the size, but basically we made about 1,500 half barrels last year. So this year I hope to make, if everything goes as planned, we'll probably have somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,200 to 1,300 barrels. If everything goes right, which it never does, we could probably make about 1,500 barrels a year, but I don't ever see that happening, just for the sake of letting beer mature to where it's supposed to mature to. I was a home brewer. That's how I got really, prior to being a home brewer, I was an enthusiast. And still am. I'm a member of the LIBME Club in Long Island, which is very similar to this. I really enjoyed watching the first big wave of the craft beer movement in Philadelphia when I was going to school there and living there in the mid-90s. Saw Victory Brewing, Sly Fox, Stouts, Trogues, all those breweries kind of up and coming, and was enjoying their beers, and that actually got me into home brewing. My wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, bought me one of those, I forget what the name is, but 2 buckets in a siphon. And the first 3 or 4 beers that I made were complete swamp water. I didn't read the directions. I read half the directions and probably fermented them too low or too high or what have you. And even, it's funny, but if you think about it, like 15 years ago, as a home brewer, there wasn't as much information as you even have now on the internet. It seems like now if we even have something in the brewery that I'm uncertain of, I can go to the internet and be like, okay, why does our pale ale taste like BP? You know, you can figure it out right away. But in my early stages of home brewing, I didn't have that type of resource. So I did extract for a while, and then I decided I wanted to make a wit beer. And that's really what pushed me in the direction of doing all grain beers. I actually brought the wit beer here today. If you guys want to start to pass that around or pour that out, you can. They have mugs over here. Did you not get them? There you go. But the wit beer, the reason that the wit beer pushed me into the direction of doing all grain brews was that I couldn't figure out a way to get a beer that light with extract or dried malt extract or light extract. So I decided that at the time I really liked Celis White and Alec Ash White. And I said, I want to make a beer like that, and so that's really what propelled me into doing an all-grain process. And then once I started doing that, it was really, it became a problem, my wife calls it. So as far as I wanted to brew, like, all the time. Up until right around the time I actually fully decided on opening the brewery in Port Jeff, I was brewing somewhere between 3 and 4 times a week, all-grain style, which is... amount of beer. I was actually dumping beer to be able to get vessels to put new beer in, to try different things. I was a big fan of multi-splits, so like I'd do a 5-gallon batch and split it into 5-gallon growlers, do different yeast or different dry hops or different temperatures and things like that. And I really attribute a lot of that into figuring out how fermentation works and how different pieces of the fermentation work. once I had decided to do the brewery, which was probably in 2008, I went off to go to Siebel because I felt like, hey, I probably need a formal brewing education more so than me mixing potions in my basement and what have you. It was a little bit difficult, but nonetheless, it was definitely a rewarding experience, and I definitely pulled some out of that. So we opened the brewery, or I started funding the brewery in about 2009, 2010. We opened in 2011, like I said. Primarily production, we go to Westchester County, New York, Suffolk, and Nassau. We have roughly 200 accounts throughout those areas. The first year we did about 16 or 17 different beers. The fact that we have a 7-barrel brew house is awesome because it allows me to still keep experimental like I would on a home brewing scale. Because if you do 7 barrels of beer, the fact is we can pretty much sell it through our tasting room without having to worry about it. And the other side is if we do 7 barrels of beer and we don't really like it, we can sell it in the tasting room, blend it with something, or throw it out. Not that I like to throw out beer, but it works sometimes. We actually have a barrel aging program that we started the first day that we opened the brewery. We do most of our barrel aging. It's just regular virgin beer and whiskey or bourbon barrels. We just acquired a couple other styles of barrels that we've been messing around with. For us, that gives us another element of exploratory brewing that you wouldn't otherwise achieve from just brewing every day, brewing the same style. It's like, all right, we need more porter, we need more pale ale. So the barrel aging really, really, I guess, sparks our interest in the creative stuff. And we do our porter in a barrel-aged version. I actually brought our virgin porter here, which is marked Chocolate Wit, today, because one of the guys in the tasting room who filled these up thought it would be funny if this was Chocolate Wit and this is our light porter. If everybody has the wit beer, I'll talk a little bit about that. That started really on a homebrew level as a Cellus White clone. Real traditional. It uses, if you were to buy the yeast from Y yeast, I guess it would be the Belgian white strain. It's pretty much all pills and a little bit of noble hops, some coriander, and some orange peel. Pretty much everything you need. We use flaked wheat, not torrefied. Yeah. Torrefied for me is really a hardship on the mill. Flaked works nice. We use a little bit of rice hulls. Our kettle or our mash tun has been great. We've never stuck a sparge, but it's not for a wit beer. We actually back down the wheat component in it, where some folks might do like a 50%. This is probably more like 35. Really, it was just getting too gooey. There was just too much. I like haze in a wit beer, but there was just a lot of gooiness. And as we were backing down the wheat initially, this was really over the course of last season, summer. So the first wit beer we made in April or May was stronger on the side of wheat and actually had a little more coriander and orange. And over the course of the season, we just backed it off and backed it off until we got pretty close to this. This is actually the first run that we did. In a 7-barrel brew house, it's amazing the variation that you get from beer to beer. Even if everything's consistent, that you know, your temperatures, your recipe, you know, the slightest little thing can really throw off the whole beer at the finish. So, what's that?
I think you nailed it.
Well, I was really happy with the first run this year. It's a lot like the last run last year. Unfortunately, wit beer doesn't keep that well, so we try to keep a couple bottles from every batch to compare. But as you guys probably well know, the unfortunate side is time. It doesn't do it justice a lot of time, but from what I remember just palate-wise, it's pretty close to what we did last year. And we love this beer in the brewery because it's like a 9 or 10 day beer for us, which turns around really quick, which from an owner standpoint and being able to move beer quickly, it's good. We never like to move beer for the sake of moving it because we have to, but when it does it on its own, it's a welcome addition.
About less grinding, too.
What's that?
Less grinding, too.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, too, because we come out of this season where our winter seasonals are something that we call the Cold North Wind, which is really a green barley wine. When I say green, we don't age it more than 6 weeks, so we have that beer, we have a stout, and then our Runaway Fairy is a smoked Imperial IPA. Those three beers all are month-plus beers, so you go from doing fermentations or having tanks that you're like, oh, that's right, that's still in there, too. Oh, there's whip beer. What is... And you start to forget what the tanks are, which is good. What's that?
Any of the barley wine?
I think they have it over at Beercraft. We bottled 22-ounce bottles of it about a month ago, and we've been letting them sit in our cellar. And we're going to release those. Last year, we released our first bottle in April was our porter. And most of my distributors were like, why are you releasing porter in April? I said, because that's what we did. I'm sorry. Maybe we should have done it in February or January, but despite the fact we still sold it all, so that was good. We're going to do the same with our Cold North Wind, primarily because the draft selection ends, so people won't be able to find it on draft, and a lot of the people that liked it, they'll be able to get in a bottle, and it kind of continues the availability, so to speak. So that'll be coming out fairly soon. We already produced three other beers in a 22-ounce bottle. Two of them are bottle condition. That's our porter, which I brought here, which we can pass around if you'd like. This is actually draft porter. It's not bottle conditioned, obviously. And we bottle condition our pale ale, which is our schooner pale ale. We do both with the Bohemian lager yeast, mostly for the finishing and clarity of it. So when we bottle condition our beers, let it ferment out, we cold crash that beer and drop the yeast out. We don't currently filter. We're actually just installing a filter right now because we have had a couple issues with longevity on bottle condition bottles, mostly from remnant yeast hanging out, and it gives it just a slight off flavor.
So are those bottle conditioned beers flat every time you bottle them, and they get conditioned and they get different?
They're flat. So what we do is, if we know we're going to bottle condition the beer, we keep it in our fermenter an extra period of time on a cold crash. And so what that'll do is pull most of the proteins and the hop matter and the yeast out of suspension and clarify the beer. We use a vegan-friendly clarifier. It's kind of like Bright Zorb or a silica gel, but it's vegan-friendly. It's not horse hoof or fish guts or whatever. When we rack that beer into the Bright tank, we'll use that fining. It'll further clarify the beer. We dump the bottom of that Bright, and then we'll keep that beer at about 32 degrees. And then the day that we bottle, we have a wine filler, so it's a non-counter-pressure filler. We'll dose the Bright tank with the appropriate amount of sugar and the Bohemian lager yeast, and then we'll tumble the Bright tank. So we come out of the dump and go through a port on the front of that Bright tank just to kind of mix it up. It's a fresh pitch that we get from the lab, or we prop from the lab just for that particular beer. And then it gets bottled, and then we'll hold that anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks before it goes out. We sample them as necessary because we bottle condition. If you ever see a case of ours, you'll see they're all numbered because you do have issues. Just like if you were homebrewing a beer, you get a little more sugar in one than the other. So those become what we call cooking beers or staff beer. From time to time, it gets a little funky, but for the most part, we have it down to a science now that we know pretty much the last 5 cases of beer that we get are going to be pretty explosive just because a lot of the sugar starts to drop out. So we do pretty much the same process for our porter and our schooner, which is our pale ale. The other beer that we bottle condition is our barrel-aged porter, and that's a little bit different because it comes out of a barrel. So we use first, second, and third fill barrels provided they pass a series of tests. So when we make the barrel-aged porter, we'll actually blend those three back into each other. Normally, some of the barrel-aged beers are a little more sharp or a little more alcohol-forward than I want them to be. So by blending back with a first fill, second fill, and third fill, you can really hit a smooth. The unfortunate part is you end up dumping or recycling a portion of some of the barrels, which we'll typically do in keg form, and then put them on for the tasting room. But basically, we'll blend those barrels through. Those will go into the Bright tank, and then we'll cloison out that beer. So when the beer is in the barrel, it oxidizes a little bit. And so by adding just a little bit of sugar and a little bit of yeast into the Bright tank, that'll consume the oxygen that was picked up in the wood aging. And then we'll do the same exact thing, Bohemian lager yeast, a little bit of sugar, and then send it to the bottle filler.
So the stuff that you separate to put on to serve in the cap, does that taste different than the bottle?
It will, yeah, sometimes. And sometimes we'll do something funky to it, or we'll... Most of the time, you're talking about like 10 gallons here, 5 gallons
right,
there.
Right.
I think the sweet spot in a barrel is the second fill. I think the first fill, there's a little bit too much oak and there's sometimes some astringency that comes with it. There's a lot of vanilla, and sometimes that can be too punchy. The last one that we put out, we actually switched up from Heaven Hill to, we put out a version that was in Jack Daniel's barrels, and I really didn't like the Jack Daniel's barrels. They were just way too oaky and way too much vanilla, and not enough of the kind of the bourbon-esque flavor that you want. And plus, that was a rough one to do because we had to basically wash barrels so they would become second fill barrels. We didn't have the opportunity to fill them and let them sit because they all came at the same time. We actually purposely took flavor out of the barrel, which sounds ridiculous, but we wanted the ability to blend. For the porter? Yeah, we're big salters when it comes to styles. We use a hell of a lot of gypsum. The water that we have in Long Island comes out pretty much on point for a lot of the beers that we want to do with just a gypsum addition.
Is that the same as New York City water?
No. The water that we have primarily in Long Island comes from aquifers. The water here, I'm not sure where it comes from, but you have probably a little
Catskills.
More treatment.
Catskills.
With Catskills? Yeah. So you have pretty good water down here, though, too. The problem with our water on Long Island is there tends to be, depending on how far you are from the pump station, you'll have a fair amount of chlorine, and also depending on the season. So we filter that out in the process coming in, and then we'll salt accordingly for the beer. So our pale ale and our porter are more English style. Pale ale is basically an English pale ale with an American twist, which is we dry hop it with CTZ. But the porter we try to keep fairly UK standard, so use a fair amount of gypsum in it to get the water to where we want. And then at the end of the porter, we use a honey in the porter to kind of sweeten it out. Porter is all Fuggle or Willamette hops. Bohemian lager yeast, we tried a few different types of yeast. I really kind of put a little bit of a think tank together about it, and that was the one that most of the people came back and said, yeah, that's probably going to be your yeast. One is it's a very clean yeast, so it won't affect the original flavor of the beer that much at that stage, especially if you use it at an ale temperature. So some of the other lagers, you get that common type of, that earthy, you know, when you do like a California common with a lager yeast, you'll get more like that earthy or like musty type of thing in the background. The Bohemian lager doesn't really do that. But the other thing is that it doesn't flake out. It gets into like really tiny particles. So if you look at the bottom of one of our bottle conditioned bottles, it doesn't have like a murky trubeness to it. We try to get most of the yeast out, but it doesn't clump up. Somebody used the term, it snows out. So, you know, you see a little bit of a collection on the bottom of the bottle, but it doesn't make like that offensive clump to some people. You or me, we might like to see the clump, but it's also extremely versatile. We basically start our bottle conditioning, we put it into our warehouse, which is temperature controlled at about 58 degrees. So the lager yeast will work at that temperature. But once it leaves my hands, it could be in a cold box, it could be in like a 90 degree room, and that yeast has enough of a variance that it actually takes care of the beer for us by not being able to be there to watch it. Be like, no, don't put it in your trunk of your car for a week. For that, it was the most versatile. It's also a fairly easy yeast to prop. It's fairly readily available. Like, sometimes you call Y yeast for a certain yeast and they don't have it for 2 weeks, and you're like, shit, that messes up the whole. I'm like, don't you guys make yeast? Don't you have yeast trees? Yeah. As far as yeast in the brewery is concerned, we try to keep it to 4 strains. It doesn't always happen, but we find after 4 strains it gets a little unmanageable for us because we have 6 fermenters. But we generally, it goes based on cell counts and viability, but we normally don't pitch much past 4 or 5 strains. We use all ales. We don't do any lagering at all. So, but funky stuff happens after around 4 or 5. The sweet spot's like 2 and 3, and then 4 can be really good, but you can have a really good fermentation at the 4th generation, and then your 5th generation can take a complete dive. And we kind of know why that is. I mean, it's all dependent on, for us, the process flow. Sometimes the yeast, you know, the first 3 batches were like almost to the day that they came out of the tank, and so that yeast is really, you've now conditioned that yeast to be used to that exact series of events. And then the last one, for whatever reason, you end up holding it and it starts to italicize, or you didn't dump right, or somebody dumped too much. And so it gets a little weird. We do the porter year-round, and that's done with the house strain. We don't have a California porter. We use a Brit ale strain for the schooner ale, which is our pale ale, the porter, and our stout. And we also use it for a beer that we make for a restaurant on Long Island. It's not a chain, it's a group of five restaurants with same ownership, which is an IPA, and we use that strain also for that beer. Then we use an American, like a cow strain, for two IPAs. We do a black IPA, a smoked imperial IPA, and we actually have a third IPA coming out, which is more like West Coast traditional IPA. For us, it took us like a year to get the hops that we wanted to use for that IPA, so we weren't able to do it. But we use an American strain for that, and then we use a Scottish strain for the barley wine. And we use the Wine Stefanale yeast for our Reisenbach. That's a pain in the ass because that's the only beer we use it for. And then we have a Belgian Trappist High Grav strain that we use for the triple in our Belgian Pale Ale. And then we use the wit for the Cellar's Clone. Yeah. Normally what happens, we had phased the barley wine out so we don't have six different yeast strains. It gets a little ridiculous once you have that many strains. Plus you have a lot more probability for cross-contaminations. It's a small house, so you got to blow off the bucket that's got poison in it next to something that you're going to dry hop or what have you. That's not a... Especially with something like the Trappist High Grav strain, that thing does whatever it wants to do, pretty much. That's a pretty... That's the Westmall yeast, yeah. Yep. So I love that yeast. That yeast is awesome because you can take it from anywhere from like 64 degrees up to 74 degrees, and it does completely different things literally at like 2-degree intervals. So if you ever get the chance, and most of you probably have or maybe tinkered with it, but if you get the chance to split a batch with Westmall yeast into like five different things and you have the way to temperature control it, check it out, and it's crazy. You end up with five different beers. As far as what we're doing in the future, we were talking, and I forget your name.
Pete.
You know, we have four 14-barrel fermenters right now and two 7-barrel fermenters, so my project of the year is to try to see if I can't get the village to allow me to put 30-barrel fermenters outside my brewery. I don't know if they're going to go for it, but I think it would be cool if they did.
Next to the tasting room.
Have you been to the tasting room?
Yeah.
We actually have two facilities. There's three facilities, really. There's the main brewery, so all the functionality of brewing happens at the tasting room facility. The brew house is there, the tanks are there, the bright tanks, we bottle there, keg wash there, there's keg storage there. We then have a warehouse that houses all of our grain. It also houses our barrels. So by the end of this month, we'll have 25 whiskey barrels that we have going in there. And then we also have, that's our bottle conditioning room. We also have a
temperature control, that's where you're aging the barrels.
Yeah, we have two different temperature controlled rooms. So we have a room that we can actually swing temperatures for the barrels. For the barrels, what we found out early on, and just through some of my talks through my friends from Avery, we switch temperatures on the barrels on just like a haphazard basis, because you want that wood to just kind of open up and close up, and it expedites the barrel aging process a little bit, but you get a lot more out of the barrel. Now the barrels might sit at 62 degrees for 10 days in a row, and then we'll drop it down to like 52 degrees or ramp it up to 75 degrees just to get that wood to expand and contract and give the additions of all the flavor it has tied into that wood.
Do you
self-distribute? We do self-distribute. I'm very much into self-distribution. The size of the brewery that I have is not conducive to handing off 25 to 30% to a distributor. With the way that the craft beer movement's going right now, I have plenty of customers, bar owners, that they very much appreciate that that's the owner that dropped the beer off, and we deal with that guy. And I'm sure in another year, everyone will have something to say about us as well as they do, like Manhattan or Union or whatever. It's nice to be able to represent your product and to train people in a bar about your product and really kind of work the framework of it from a standpoint of self-distribution. we made the decision a couple months ago. We just bought another van. I hired another guy to self-distribute. So we actually sell and deliver. If you drink anything in Brooklyn or New York, I deliver it and sell it myself. At the brewery, I have a head brewer. I go to the brew house until about noon, and then I leave to deliver. So we have a brewer and a cellarman who take care of most of the things. I just kind of oversee, give advice where I see fit, but otherwise let them run with it. There's really four of us full-time, and then another six that are part-time, who are like either tasting room people or social media guy. We have three intern positions that we fill at any given time. There's a lot of things that go into it. You create a budget and you create a plan. The actual licensing, like federal-wise and state-level-wise, the state was harder than federal. They have a lot more to say and a lot more things going on. More of the red tape was based on a municipal level of, like, can we dump this in the sewer? Why can't we get three-phase electric? Like, just stupid stuff. Or somebody coming in and doing an assessment and saying, you need fire alarms here, here, and here, and then you get the inspection done, and it's like, well, no, you don't need one there. You need three over here. Dude, do you guys even, like, talk to each other? So that was more of the red tape, I think, than actually getting the licensing. The licensing, if you think about it, the federal government, they want your excise dollars, so they want to make tax from you. And the state, to some degree, is the same way. But the state has a responsibility to the people to make sure that a couple different things, that somebody's not opening something that's going to ultimately fail, and that also they're getting their excise dollars and not having somebody like making methamphetamine or something. Oh, we make a load of methamphetamine. Right, that's what keeps us afloat.
Under the bridge.
Well, I'm going to be here hanging out, so if you guys got any questions or whatever, come on over. I hope you guys enjoyed the beer, and thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.